I'm Tamar Lawrence Samuel from Corporate Accountability International, and we are here today for a press conference on a report that Corporate Accountability International has released, and to hear from both of our speakers here as well about the influence of corporations on climate policy. I will take a moment to introduce Corporate Accountability International briefly, as well as our two speakers, and I will then talk a little bit about the report and U.S. level industry interference and influence on policy, and then let them take it away, and then conclude with a note about the solution that is being proposed to address this problem. As I said, Corporate Accountability International is a member-powered organization that challenges the life-threatening abuses of transnational corporations, some of the most abusive and powerful corporations in the world, including the tobacco industry, the private water industry, and the fast food industry. And Corporate Accountability International works with governments to secure regulatory measures to protect against the abuses of these industries. And the reason we're here in Paris at COP21 this year is because we've just launched a project called Kick Big Polluters Out. It is a campaign, a global movement of southern and northern organizations and people calling on parties to the UNFCCC to insulate climate policy making, both at the national level and at the international level, from the harmful influence of fossil fuel transnationals and other emissions-intensive industries. So on our panel today, we have Olivier Hoedeman from Corporate Europe Observatory. He will discuss EU-level corporate interference and how that affects EU climate policy. And then we'll hear from Asad Rehman with Friends of the Earth International, who will talk about how the influence of the industry plays out here at the international level at the UNFCCC negotiations. So I will start us off with a brief note about the report that Corporate Accountability International released just last week. The report is called Fueling the Fire, the Big Polluters Bankrolling COP21. So overall, the main findings of the report is that the very corporations that are driving the climate crisis are also bankrolling the talks. And inherent in that is an irreconcilable conflict of interest. When corporations whose profit motives are in direct contradiction with the social and environmental outcomes of a policy process and the objectives of the UNFCCC, and when these corporations are permitted to sponsor the talks, this is called greenwashing. These corporations are buying themselves undeserved legitimacy, access to policymakers, and influence on policy outcomes. And some of the most egregious specific findings of the report, for example, are that just four of the COP21 sponsors are responsible for more than 200 megatons of CO2 equivalent emissions and more than 46 coal-fired power plants. Of those 200 megatons, utility corporation Engie emits over 131 megatons per year. That's equivalent to more than 500 billion kilometers, or 12 times the distance around the Earth by car. Another corporate sponsor, BNP Paribas, one of the worst banks in France, is one of the largest coal financiers. And between 2005 and 2014, this corporation provided half of the total financing by French banks, which is about 15 billion euro for the coal industry globally. And finally, just another teaser from the report, EDF, Electricité de France, has been working alongside Shell, ExxonMobil, and others to block the deployment of renewables throughout Europe via Business Europe, the trade association. But sponsorship, as the report details, is only a symptom of a larger ailment. in this UNFCCC and climate policy arena. This is just the tip of the iceberg. The real damage, as I noted, is the effects on policy that this has, the weakened, delayed, and blocked national policies, but also international negotiating positions. So let me take a moment just to talk a little bit about US-level interference and just to outline a couple of examples of corporate interference and the impacts on US policy. I think we need to look no further than the recent investigations about Exxon to confirm without a fraction of a doubt that for decades, Exxon has been in the business of sowing doubt and undermining public policy, sowing doubt about climate science and undermining public policy. Another example is a recent MapLight analysis of Open Secrets oil and gas industry data. And this analysis finds that, you know, one way that industry has obscured influence is from the public is via political contributions. And so influence, in spite of this attempt to obscure the influence, was measured in this recent study, which found that senators in the U.S. who rejected human-caused climate change had received 7 times more money from oil and gas interests. And the example that is highlighted is that while construction of the Keystone XL pipeline was rejected by Congress, the voting on key amendments was really quite telling. Senators who voted against an amendment that expressed Congress's view that human activities were significantly contributing to climate change received on average 7.1 times as much money from oil and gas industry compared to those voting yes on that amendment between April 2009 and March 2015. So that's just a couple of examples in the US context, but now I'll let our speakers tell us a little bit more about the effects of corporate interference on EU-level policy, with Olivier first.
Yeah, thank you very much. Well, in Europe we have the situation that public opinion wants strong and effective climate policies, but the EU is not delivering, and the gap is getting bigger and bigger. And the influence of corporate lobby groups and large companies over EU climate policy is becoming a major obstacle for ambitious climate policies, the kind of policies that the public expects. My organization, Corporate Europe Observatory, we have documented many examples of this, of how this capture of decision-making happens. Let me highlight just one, which is the 2030 climate and energy targets of the EU. The European Commission prepared these in 2013 and 14, and they are very much the basis of the EU's negotiating position here as well. And based on documents that we received through freedom of information requests, we've been able to reconstruct how the Commission's proposal was systematically weakened by industry lobbying, by privileged access that was given to companies like Shell, like E.ON, like ENGIE, and Business Europe, which is the lobby group really pushing for the lowest common denominator also for climate policy. So this resulted in a weakening of the targets for greenhouse gas emissions, a crucial problem. So it's now too unambitious to prevent the 2 degrees heating, but also scrapping of binding targets for governments for renewable energy and for energy efficiency. So really a weakening of the package that existed for the 2020 targets. And what was left in terms of instruments was more or less only the emissions trading system that is also seriously dysfunctional because of industry lobbying resulting in enormous amounts of free permits for big polluters. So the carbon price solo that the whole emissions trading system is more or less meaningless. Just one example of this extreme pattern of privileged access. At a key moment in the decision-making, November 2013, a whole-day meeting inside the Commission headquarters with Business Europe and companies that are members of Business Europe, like ENGIE, ArcelorMittal, and so on, with the Commission President and the top Commission officials preparing for this 2030 package. And coincidentally, exactly the same thing is happening this very day, today. There is a seven-hour meeting today in the Commission headquarters in the Berlaymont with Commission President Juncker and five commissioners with Business Europe and the same collection of big polluters. You can see our website for more on that event today. Our conclusion is that things have gotten worse during the Juncker Commission that took office a year ago. We've analyzed the meetings that the climate and energy commissioners, Kanieta and Shevkovic, have had with lobbyists in their first 12 months. And we found quite shockingly that 80% of their meetings were with industry lobbyists. And if you look at the meetings with the energy sector, 75% of those meetings were with fossil fuel companies. So completely the wrong way around. The revolving door is spinning faster and faster. And the latest example is of a leading coal industry lobbyist that has gone to the European Commission through the revolving door and is now responsible for a key responsible official for EU policies on coal. So these are just some examples of how EU climate policy is increasingly eroded by this privileged access and excessive influence of corporate lobby groups. And this is why we very much support the call for kicking big polluters out and protecting climate policies from their influence. Thanks.
Thank you, Olivier. Asad, take it away on corporate interference here at Triple C.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think, and first of all, thank you for the report, which I think is very, very important. I think for anybody who's serious about understanding what takes place in these negotiating halls and why we're unable to reach the kind of fair and ambitious agreement that is required, we need to be able to look at the fact that there actually is countervailing forces here, powerful vested interests whose business it is to either slow down change or to ensure that the policy put forward continue to benefit the small elite and the corporations rather than benefit the majority of people. And you've heard, of course, both about how the European Union and the United States have both their policy positions are influenced by the corporations and the dirty energy companies in particular. And, you know, here we only need to walk around and, of course, you see both Engie, you see BNP sponsoring this COP, responsible for much of the dirty energy projects across the world. And we know that, of course, at a national level, as well as at a regional and a global level, aggressive lobbying through a plethora of trade associations is a reality. But the specific lobbying, particularly from corporations to scrap binding regulations that takes place at a national level, is also influenced here in terms of at an international level. If you want to understand why we moved from a science-based top-down approach in terms of tackling the climate crisis to a deregulated approach, then we have to look at who benefits from that kind of model. And it benefits the corporate model of the big dirty energy corporations. And they much prefer, just like their approach in terms of corporate accountability is around voluntary corporate standards, they much prefer that our response to the climate crisis is as such, is also about the voluntary standards. And we see that with the intended nationally determined contributions. The COP itself, of course, in the last few years has been brought into serious question because of the formal role of the COP with dirty energy corporations. Those of you who are in Warsaw in COP19 will remember the relationship that there was, not only in terms of the sponsors with dirty energy and fossil fuel sponsorship, but the fact that the Polish government actually, as the president, co-hosted the International Coal and Climate Summit as a parallel to the COP with the World Coal Association. And in fact, the Christiana Figueres, the UNFCCC executive secretary, gave the keynote speech there. And it's no accident then that we see both at a national level now this argument about clean coal as being about delivering energy poverty. So the issues that have come from civil society organizations around issues around energy access and energy poverty have now been subsumed by these corporations to be able to justify their business as usual. In the Lima COP, Friends of the Earth, we released a report that looked at how Anglo-American particularly had been lobbying for the subsidies for renewable energy, against subsidies for renewable energies, because of course they wanted to continue to favour dirty energies such as coal and gas. You'll hear in the next few days about the Lima-Paris Action Plan and talk about stakeholders and the importance of having these stakeholders and non-state actors at the in the room to determine climate policy. Of course, that jars with civil society organisations who find themselves barred from the negotiating rooms. In reality, what we're talking about is that the idea is to give even these multinationals not only more the access that they've already got, but to give them even more privileged access. It's like not only are we that they've got a grip on our policy, now we actually want to put them in the driving seat. And it's developing country campaigners and from the Global South have often said that's like putting Dracula in charge of a blood bank. And in reality it is, because what we're talking about here is now moving away from the argument that climate change is not real, but to argue how slow we deal with the impacts of climate change. And that, of course, has a big influence. If you look at the policies that have been put forward, and particularly by the European Union, we see their obsession. One of their priorities have always been the carbon markets, about extending the discredited ETS scheme to a global carbon market. If you look at the fights, for example, around how do we stop deforestation, around the RED mechanism, which again privileges multinationals and corporations. If we look now also at the language around net zero, for example, in terms of the global goal, the net zero argument, of course, many of you may have already seen, is specifically being put forward by large business interests who want to continue to be able to argue that you can continue the business model as usual. All we need to look at is technical fixes, whether that's CCS or net zero in terms of using what's called marginal land to be able to suck carbon out of the atmosphere. I think the reality is, of course, when we talk also in these negotiations, it's hard for us to separate what's going on here with what's going on around globally. And it becomes impossible for us to recognize that when the European Union or the UK government or EU leaders or President Obama stand on the stage as they did on Monday and talk about the importance of tackling climate change, and at the same time negotiating free trade agreements like TTIP and CETA and TTP, which privileges dirty energy corporations. And when we look at who are the two biggest corporate associations that are pushing for that, then we see that it's, of course, the food industry and dirty energy corporations, and of course that they are the ones that are most beneficial, that most benefit from that trade agreement. And of course they are part of what we would call the solution package. If we want to tackle the climate crisis, of course we all recognize we have to change our current model of how we produce and consume our energy and how we produce and consume our food system. I'll stop there, and if there's any questions.
Thank you so much. So let me pivot a little bit and talk about the solution to the problem we've just heard. We've heard how the undue influence of emissions-intensive industries are a major obstacle to climate policy internationally and at the national level. And what we also learned from the Exxon revelations just recently is how directly the fossil fuel industry is pulling plays from the big tobacco playbook. The solution that is being put forward here is that, very fortunately, there is an existing international legal precedent within UN treaty law that allows parties to safeguard their sovereignty in policymaking and provides them the tools to do so. The World Health Organization explicitly recognizes the need to identify, mitigate, and avoid conflicts of interest with regards to industries, most notably the tobacco industry, that interfere with public health policymaking to pursue profit at any cost. And in contrast to the WHO, this institution, the UNFCCC, has not even identified the potential for such conflicts of interest in the context of policymaking. And in fact, it's quite the opposite. So 10 years ago, just about 10 years ago now, Corporate Accountability International played a lead role with a global network of civil society organizations and worked closely with parties to secure a powerful international legal precedent. Corporate Accountability International led the charge to successfully kick the tobacco industry through this precedent out of treaty talks at the World Health Organization negotiations. And the success of the Global Tobacco Treaty as a result has enabled meaningful public health regulation that is unencumbered by industry profit motives and that protects 90% of the world's population from one of the most deadly industries on the planet. So the precedent that is established by Article 5.3 of the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control establishes this irreconcilable conflict of interest between the tobacco industry and the interests of public health policy making. But most importantly, what it does is it bars the tobacco industry from participating and interfering in the policy making process, the development of policies, but also the implementation of policies. And through a series of guidelines, the Global Tobacco Treaty has provided its parties with tools to facilitate implementation of this article at the national level. And what Article 5.3 has done, the impact of Article 5.3 in the world, is that it has allowed for the strongest possible safeguards for public health from the Philippines to Colombia to prevent industry interference and to allow Australia, Norway, and other countries as well have passed really, really incredible measures that, for example, protect public health through graphic health warnings, through taxation, and other evidence-based policies for tobacco control. So this is what is possible at the UNFCCC. And I want to leave you with a couple of really tangible ways that you can take action. The first is that there has been a global call for the parties to the UNFCCC to kick big polluters out. Over 500,000 people have joined this call. Please join these people and join these organizations who are calling on parties to do so by visiting kickbigpolluters.org. And I will turn it over to reporters now for questions first. If you could identify yourself, your name, your outlet, and please stand up when you ask the question, that would be great. Thank you.
Hi, Kyla from DSMOG UK. A lot of people say that we need to engage with business. We need them to help us tackle climate change. We've seen some announcements or campaigns such as Peabody's Advanced Energy for Life or the carbon pricing call from some of the European energy companies. How do these help with the Paris talks and negotiations?
I think we recognize in terms of tackling the climate crisis, we need all sectors to play their part. The question is in terms of course, is who determines the role of each of those sectors, and is it the state and governments acting in the interests of its citizens, or are the solution package that's being put forward in the interest of business and corporations? And I think that's really the determining factor. So, of course, there is a role for the private sector, but the question here is this the place for it? So when you see, for example, the United States talking about in terms of adaptation or talking about in terms of loss and damage, those and saying, well, what we need is insurance schemes, then you have to start questioning, well, actually, let's think about that. What are we talking about? An insurance scheme for the poorest to be able to deal with the impacts of climate change? Well, look, let's trace that back and look at the powerful insurance companies in the United States who've been lobbying for that as the solution. So what I would say is, of course, there are important announcements, but they don't substitute for the actions of governments. Governments are the ones that determine economy-wide policies and processes. And what we need to see here is government announcements and not announcements from private corporations.
And if I may just add, I think one of the dangers with these voluntary schemes is that they undermine the political will of governments to take action. They purport to address these problems in a way that is significant and sufficient when in reality they can't possibly do so because that would be counter to the interests of the corporations putting them forward.
Hello, Judy Saul, Cape Town Television and South African Television. What you've just said, as far as I'm concerned, makes COP21 fatally flawed because we know that what the outcome's going to be because it's been generated another way. And it seems like we cannot leave it at that and say, well, that's sad. We've got to say something's got to be done. It's got to be somebody else has got to do it. So would you not be prepared to lead something like that where the ordinary people bypass this whole farce and go into doing something about really creating solutions using the public's money, which is what the government's trying to use, but of course not for the right reasons?
I think there's a recognition broadly among civil society organizations that our ability to be able to influence the negotiations purely by advocacy alone, that the traditional approach that governments will act rationally if we provide them the evidence briefings and reports on the seriousness of the climate crisis and provide them the correct policy solutions, they will adopt those policy solutions and we will see constructive engagement. That actually has been shown over the last 21 years, but even prior to that, we as Friends of the Earth ran our first ever climate campaign in 1978. The reality is, of course, that governments aren't acting rationally. So how do you make governments act rationally? Well, we can only do that when we're much more powerful. So part of, I think, most of civil society organizations is also about what are we doing at a national and at a global level? How are we building our power about targeting and making people understand that the climate crisis is about how the model of energy is produced and consumed. It is about our food system, and it is about how we are cutting down forests. And if we start to deconstruct climate in terms of that, and rather than see climate as a technical solution, it gives people much more power to be able to influence their own decision makers to make sure that we come here with the correct mandates.
That's all for now. If you have more questions, please, we'll be right outside afterwards. Thank you so much for joining us.